Morning, everyone. My name is Michael Donnelly. I'm an alcoholic. And what a tremendous joy to be here this weekend, really. From Sonia's music to Steve picking us up at the airport, tremendous speakers, new friends I've made, Dick and Barbara for organizing this. Let's give them and everyone else a round of applause. The volunteers, the committee. I want to mention the tapers. You know, for new people, there's been a lot of names that have been dropped this weekend. Names like Sandy Beach, who you may not know, right? Even Bill Wilson. Oh, that's the old guy. I think he started this thing. Or, you know, who's the other guy with the glasses? You know, that kind of stuff. And the great ministry about taping is that we have an opportunity, whether we're here for 2 days or 25 or 35 years, to listen to the wisdom that comes through this fellowship from its origin today. And I think that the tapers get seen a lot, but I don't think that they're appreciated enough. And I just want to just take a second and give him a round of applause, and the other ones as well that are here, that allow us the opportunity to learn from the people that came before us. With that being said, look, I met Brian. I've had a lot of conversations with Brian over the years, but I think the most significant one in my life came somewhere in the middle of July in 1991. And I had gone through the trials and tribulations that most of us do. I was a drunk who would pass out at the wheel, and I'd hit medians on Cicero Avenue coming home. And I'd hit them so hard I'd dent the rims on my wheels, and I'd drive on donuts for months, you know. Months and months and months on donuts, and they'd tease me about it. And I'd crack jokes about it too, because I didn't know how to live responsibly. And one afternoon I had decided that I'd had enough and I was going to kill myself. And in our sales office, you had to go down an L-shaped hallway to go to the bathroom. And I was in the corner of that L-shaped hallway with my two forearms on the wall, and I had my head in my hands, wondering how I would kill myself without my mom finding out, because that would have destroyed her. So I'm trying to plan the event. I grew up in Chicago. My dad was, and still to this day, is absolutely my hero. He was a Korean War veteran, honorable guy. He was a police officer, rose through the ranks quickly in Chicago, and when I was 6 years old, he went off to work and he didn't come home. Artery broke in his bowel. They can fix that today with their eyes closed, but back then they couldn't do very much about my dad. At 42 years old, he bled to death, and it just destroyed our family. And emotionally, I mean, it destroyed our family. It just crushed us all. My dad was the kind of guy that when you were around him, you always felt secure. My dad was the kind of guy that brought safety to our home and security and just a strong foundation of just basic principles of living that most people already know, but that my dad taught me, went out of his way to teach me even though I was a little guy. And my mom was another saint, right? She was a perfect, quintessential Irish Catholic mother, and she really did her best to raise my sister and I well, and she got it about 50% right, because my sister's a gem, and then there's me. And in between passing out on her front lawn and coming home with shrubbery sticking out of the bumper when I didn't know where the heck the shrubbery came from, you know, dodging police at different times in my life, you know, she somehow prayed me to this meeting with Brian, without probably her even knowing she was doing it. But that's the beautiful part about the 10th and 11th step. I did not get to Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm smart. I did not get to Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm bright or wise or knew I needed help. I guess I knew I needed help, but that's not what brought me here. I think what brought me here to all of you was the prayers that my mom said. All those years through my whole life when she didn't even know what she was praying for. But somehow God could sort of help me and help her through those answered prayers to get me to this message that Brian carried to me in that hallway. And I don't even know if he knew this, but I was thinking about throwing myself in front of the L. We have an elevated track in Chicago. A lot of people sometimes fall in front of it and get killed. And I was thinking about doing that because then my mom wouldn't know it was suicide. And I remember thinking, no, because then the conductor has to deal with that for the rest of his life. And I have a bus, so same thing. And I decided to, one night, maybe that night, take my seatbelt off and get my car up as fast as I could and ride it into one of the viaducts going downtown on 57. And then I remember just in an instant, somewhere I read that the police know when it's a suicide attempt and when a person actually falls asleep or passes out and drives into something, and it's because there are skid marks right before impact. And I remember thinking to myself, you're a chicken. You'll hit the brakes. She'll know. Now, it took me probably a minute to explain that to you. It took about a nanosecond for all of that to run through my head, right? And all of a sudden from behind me, I heard, Mike, are you okay? For the first time in my life, I said no. Because I've been asked that question since I was a kid. You okay? Yeah, I got it. Everything all right? I'm okay, I got it. I'll figure it out. It's going to be all right. Couldn't let anyone in. Couldn't let anyone in. And this man was in a group that didn't just have meetings. This group worked the big book as best they could. This group was a step working group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And because men like Tom, who taught Brian and walked that road with Brian, and other men that taught Brian, Brian had the right words for me on some random day in the middle of July. And that's why I'm standing here today. He took me to my first meeting and he gave me my first big book. Shortly thereafter, I got transferred to South Dakota. And trust me, that's an upgrade. And people are like, you live in South Dakota? And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, why do you live in South Dakota? If you've never been there, it's one of the most beautiful states in our wonderful country. I just love South Dakota. It's amazing. A couple of applause. Hey, you've got one in the crowd. Very good. Two in the crowd. And so I'm living in this terrible, terrible hotel. And I can't pay my bills. And Brian's wiring me money. And I'm getting squared every pay period and wiring money back. Neither one of us had checking accounts. We were the kind of executives that uses currency exchanges. You know, $300 suits and going to the currency exchange. That's kind of, thought we were really cool. So finally I got an apartment and I got a checking account. And was going to meetings and met this guy named Joe. His name was Joe Friday, and he became my first sponsor. It's a great name for an AA sponsor, by the way, Joe Friday. And Joe saved my life. I asked him if he would be my sponsor, and he said, I don't know. What I will do is go to coffee with you, and I'll tell you my story, and then you can tell me your story. And if you think, and I think that we can work together, I'll sponsor you. And so we went to this place called the Crackpot, ironically. And we sat there and we chugged coffee, and you could smoke everywhere in those days, and chain smoking and chugging coffee, and he tells me a story. And I really don't remember that I heard very much of that story. I could probably repeat it to you today only because Joe was such an important part of my life. I'd heard it many, many times after that. But at the moment of him finishing that, I don't know that I heard very much. And he said, okay, you tell me your story. And I was somewhere in the neighborhood of 90 to 120 days sober, and I didn't really know I had one. And at the end of it, he said, Mike, you have no idea what alcoholism is, do you? And I said, no, I do. It's, you know, when you get drunk a lot. And he said something that, again, just, man, sometimes these one sentences touch our lives in dramatic ways. And he said, alcoholism has almost nothing to do with being drunk. And I was, what was that? He said, alcoholism is a threefold disease, and drunkenness is the untreated result of having alcoholism. When you don't treat your alcoholism, you end up drunk. But that's a symptom, Mike. That's not what it is. And he intrigued me. And he went to explain the allergy that Dr. Silkworth so eloquently writes out in our book. This inability to control my drinking once I started. And he talked to my heart about that in such a way that I had never really heard anyone else say that or describe it that way. And after he explained this allergy, he said, Mike, do you have that? I said, yeah, I think I got that. He said, the second thing you have, Mike, is an obsession of the mind. Your mind lies to you and you believe it. Just again, like Dr. Silkworth says when he claims that we have an inability to differentiate the true from the false in life. I got that. And I don't know about your wolves, but my come disguised as sheep. Alcohol never said to me, "Let's go out tonight, Mike. I'm going to make sure that you hurt everyone you love." Never told me that. It never told me, "Go out and you're going to be gone for 2 days and not call anyone." It never told me, "Go out and call in, you'll be calling in sick tomorrow again." It never told me that. Here's what it said. "What are you going to do? Never go out and have fun anymore? You're really never going to have any friends? That's really what you're trying to do here? Why can't you just go out and have two? Leave the car keys at home. Someone will call a cab. Don't bring her." And there was a lot of things it told me. And they were all wrong. I had the inability to differentiate the true from the false that Dr. Silkworth tells us about. And then Joe looked across the table from me and he said, "Do you have that?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You know, Mike, I only heard a little bit of your story, or what you thought was your story, but I got a feeling that your mind lies to you about a hell of a lot more than just drinking." He says, "I think you judge people by the way they look and their income and their education level and their political dispositions. And I think you judge everyone." You know, when he was right, it wasn't 24 hours before that I was walking through the mall. And every single person who was coming the opposite way, I'm like, "Look at that fat guy, look at that idiot, look at that moron, look at this idiot, blah, 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 blah." My head was just full, and I had never seen that mirror before. He'd never seen the mirror before. And I said, "Yeah, I got that." He says, "Well, if you round up, you got alcoholism, because that's 2/3. He says, "And that's good news, because we have a solution for alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous." He said, "The bad news is we won't be able to do anything about your allergy because we're not doctors, and we'll never be able to do anything about your mind because we're not psychiatrists and counselors. Contrary to popular belief, we are not." So the only thing that Alcoholics Anonymous works on is the third part. And if you have that, welcome home. And I made the foolish decision to ask him, "What the heck was the third part?" He said, "We have a broken soul. We have a broken soul." And it scared me. It just scared me. And he said, "The number one symptom of a broken soul is lack of power." He said, "Do you have lack of power, Mike?" I said, I don't think so. He said, "Well, let me ask you a series of questions and then you can define it for yourself whether or not you have a lack of power." I said, "Okay." He said, "Mike, is it wrong to lie?" And I go, "Well, yeah." And he goes, "Do you lie?" "Well, you know, only when absolutely necessary." I mean, he said, "Is it wrong to speak disrespectfully to your mom?" I go, "Yeah." He goes, "How's that going?" "Not so good." "How about, is it wrong to objectify women, use them, belittle them?" "No." "How you doing there?" "Not so good either." "How about money? Is it wrong to be collecting a paycheck from a job that you're actually not working at?" I went, "Well, for some people." Back to question one, is it wrong to lie? Right, we went through this thing. And he said, "You know, I've heard a lot over these last couple of weeks that I've gotten to know you, but you complaining about your dad dying and how your mom was a waitress and you didn't have very much money and all this sob story crap." He says, "You know what? All that might be true, and all that probably affected you. I have no doubt it did. But somewhere along the line, you were raised right. Because you got all of the behavior questions right. You just got none of the application questions right. So wherever it was you came from that you think is so bad, they taught you well, kid. You just couldn't put it together." And Joe and I walked through the remaining steps. He began to sponsor me that day. And he said, "Do you have that third part?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Welcome home. We got a solution for that. And when that's fixed, the other two take care of themselves." Just like our big book tells us in the fourth step, right? When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. We don't straighten out physically and mentally and then get spiritually well. It's the opposite. So he said, "Tell me about God." And I said, "Well, he must be big and he must be nice. Because he made all this stuff and he's sounds like he's giving me a second chance, so he must be big and he must be nice. And that's where I started. And on page 47 of our big book, it says, "Do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you." And he gave me that exercise, and he said, "I want you to go to the big book, and I want you to find 40 terms in that big book, and I want you to define them. Not your mom, not your priest, I want you to define them." And what we did is we folded that piece of paper, and we put it in the back of the big book. And he said, "When we get to step 12, I'll bet you your definitions have improved. I'll bet you they're different. I'll bet you they're more intimate. I'll bet you they're more personal." And he was right. And the rest of that paragraph that promises that that exercise will allow me a first conscious relation with God as I understand Him came true. It's a tremendous paragraph. So I did that. Big, large, nice, right? And from that we got on our knees and we said the third step prayer. And he was very, very direct on this. He said, "Do not be illusioned that the third step is merely a prayer. It's a prayer stating your commitment to work 4 through 12. So, page 64 says, "Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face." And Joe told me that was 4 and 5. And to get rid of, or be rid of, he told me that was 6 through 12. "The things in myself which have been blocking me." So I committed to work 4 through 12 with Joe. And we wrote my fears, my resentments, and my sex conduct down. And he said, each one of these sections of the four step has not only a writing part and a thinking part, Mike, but it has a prayer part. And he was right. And he was right. Look, I love that idea of when I resent someone to pray for that person for 2 weeks. And that's a wonderful thing. You'll never hear me talk anybody out of praying for somebody. But in the first 164, when it comes to resentments, ironically, I'm supposed to pray for me, as if I am the one chiefly violating myself with that anger. It says, "Dear God, save me from being angry. Save me from being angry. Show me how I might be helpful to that person." Do I have to be helpful to the people I resent? I think so. In fears, prayers in fear, right? It says we ask God to remove prayer. At once we began to outgrow fear. By just praying? Yep. By just praying. And then sex. You know, it's funny. We have two paragraphs for 6 and 7. We talk about them forever. We have a page and a half on what the big book calls a sane ideal for our future sex life. And it goes for, depending on your definition, about a page to a page and a half. And what I did, according to Joe, directions, and the big book, is when I got done with my sex inventory, I went back to it and I asked myself what I should have done instead. And it says I got all this down on paper. And it says from that I'm supposed to produce something called a sane and sound ideal for my future sex life. I can tell you, the first one wasn't necessarily sane. It was probably somewhat idealistic, but it was not sane. And it wasn't very good, but it was better. So I went to this priest, because Joe told me to go to this priest. His name was Father Ed. And Father Ed said, "Yeah, I'll hear your fifth step." And I sat down with that guy for 6 hours, and I told him everything I had written down. He invited God to be in there with us, right? And it was amazing. But I'll tell you what was even more profound for me was that hour afterward. On the bottom of page 75, it gives us some directions. We're supposed to go home, be quiet for an hour, pull the book off our shelf, right? Look at the first 5 proposals and ask ourselves, have we skipped on anything? Try to make mortar without sand. Basically, Mike, are you telling the truth? Are you conning someone this time, or are you serious? And then on 76, if we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step 6. And I struggled here because I thought willingness was about wanting to. And I don't think it is. I don't think it is. I think willingness is just about doing it, not knowing what the fruit of it will be, not knowing whether or not at the end of this, as I listen to this old guy named Joe, I'm going to get any fruit from this, anything good from this at all. But just do it. Just do it. Not tagging As Don mentioned, every single decision I make based on my feelings, at some point I have to let go and be led. And their prayer requests, 6 and 7, are prayer requests as we so eloquently heard, just greatly heard this week. And moves us right into 8 and 9. And I think God answers those questions, those prayer requests, those petitions, if you will, in 6 and 7 as we do 8 and 9. I can pray for God to change my financial situation all day long, and if I don't make financial amends, I will not change financially. I can ask God to change my sexual behavior, and if I don't change my sexual behavior and make restitution and amends for the selfishness in my life in 8 and 9, I don't think He's going to do it. He might. I will never question grace. What a beautiful song. Beautiful song. I lost it 3 times this weekend. Mari's Talk, Silent Light, and Amazing Grace. Just beautiful. Thank you for that. So I'm not challenging God's grace. He can do whatever He wants to do. In my life, He's asking me to come along. He's asking me to be His partner, I think. And it's a give and take sometimes. But the give is so small compared to what we get to take. So as I went down this list, I ran into things. Ran into things all over the place as I wrote down this list in 8. And as I went to these people, I learned some things about 10 and 11 that I'm going to share. But to me, steps 1 through 9 are the basis to make 10 and 11 have a lot of fruit, have a lot of really good results from it. Because I'm picking up as I go through this process little bits, little snippets of what God's will for my life might be like. What my life might look like. And it was encouragement to me to continue on in 10 and 11. And so as I went through the ninth step, I hadn't filed federal income tax for 4 years prior to joining Alcoholics Anonymous. Whoops-a-daisy. And slight oversight. And found this accountant in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he sat me down and we went through all the paperwork. And we got it all worked out, and for 3.5 years, every single month, I sent a check to the IRS. And I don't owe them anything today. I had about $40,000 of credit card debt, and I can tell you there were no large screen TVs on it. It was pizza and beer money, coupled with late payment charges, probably triple-digit interest, I don't know. I paid my bills on the color coding system, which the white one is Kindling, right? The yellow is be careful because the next notice is coming soon. And then the red one is hurry up, make a panic call to the creditor. That's how I paid my bills. That had to change. No peace of mind with a life like that for me. And if there's no peace of mind in my life, I'm going to seek relief. And I only know 2 things that give me relief. Conscious contact with God and the first drink. Almost every single time, just like the doctor's opinion talks about, I got a sense of ease and comfort. I call it the great exhale. When I'd leave work, when I worked with Brian, I'd be racing down the interstate with my hands clenched in the 10 and 2 position, white knuckling that steering wheel, frantically changing the radio station, trying to find a song I like, just anything to turn my head off. And when I'd finally pull up to this place called Brubaker's on 104th and Western Avenue on the south side of Chicago, and Fat John would slide a beer down to me and I'd put it up to my lips, I got this every single time. I was really far from drunk. Really far from drunk. But the first couple of sips of booze did something to me that it doesn't do to my sister and it doesn't do to the vast majority of other humans walking around planet Earth, but it did it to me. And it did it to me from the very first time I drank. I got a sense of ease and comfort from the first drink. And if I don't get my life right, the knots in my guts that are produced from living contrary to just standard basic principles of life, I'm going to drink again. I don't know about you, but I know that I am. Because I am a wimp, and I don't like any knots in my guts, like the smallest ones. I don't like them at all. And as I went through this process, not only making financial amends, but reaching out to the women that I had hurt, going to bosses, going to teachers, going to my mom, something happened inside of me, and it changed me. And as Don had mentioned, I believe I had that spiritual awakening as a result of the first 9 steps. I looked at life different. My mom, I couldn't walk into a room when she was there and say anything nice to her. Because when she said hello, I knew what she meant. Hi, honey, how are you? Oh, please, don't start with me. I mean, that was exactly, that's about it. I know where you're going with this. A little bit of a short wick. And Joe said, really got to make this right with your mom. I said, Joe, I don't know how to do it. He said, well, every time you go home, I want you to hug her. I go, my mom and I don't hug. He goes, I'm not talking to your mom. I told you to hug your mom. I didn't say anything to your mother about hugging back. So I'm a few months sober, and I go home, and it's probably Christmassy, I guess, and put my arms around my mom, and she just frigid up. It's the first time I tried to hug her in years. No wonder she did that. It wasn't a personal rejection. It's called shock, right? And I went back at St. Patrick's Day, because I'm genetically obligated to be there on St. Patrick's Day. And I gave her another hug, and she was less tense. I came back for Thanksgiving, and I can bring you to the spot in my mom's house where her arms came up behind my lower back and returned the hug. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to quit drinking. What I really longed for was a hug from my mom. I didn't know it till I got a hug from my mom. He also said, you're going to start communicating with your mom. And I said, you don't understand. My mom and I don't talk well together. He goes, I'm not talking to your mom. So I started calling my mom. He said, I want you to ask her two questions. The first one is, Mom, how was your week? And the second one is, wow, that sounds great. Could you tell me more about that? And he goes, early in this process, you have scarred her. She's the woman, don't forget, Mike, whose house you would break into and steal money from her purse. She does not trust you, nor should she. Nor should she. You haven't paid her a dime back yet. Just call her and ask her how her week was, and whatever she says, ask her to tell you more about it. And I did that. And the first call was exactly like that. Hey, Ma, how was your week? Fine. Wow, that sounds interesting. Could you tell me more about that? It's awkward and uncomfortable, and I hated it. But I got to tell you, something crazy happened after a few months of doing it. Her answers got longer. You know, Roberta's going to take me to lunch. Kitty picked me up the other day. We went to Mass and had breakfast after it. Good homily. And what's even stranger is a couple of weeks after that, I began to care about the answers. And I don't know how that happened. I don't know how that happened. So when I'd call her then, I'd be like, hey, Ma, how'd that thing at work go? And I began to communicate with my mom. I didn't know I needed that. I had no idea that I needed that. I didn't know she needed it. So through this process of the first 9 steps, I began to learn a little bit, about what I think the essence of 10 and 11 are. 10 is simply the reoccurring practice of what I learned in 1 through 9 on a moment-to-moment basis. So I don't know about your life, I just know about mine. And I can walk through the hall, or I can be at work, or I can be sitting on the TV watching something with my wife, or I can be hanging out with my grandkids, and thoughts just can fly at me. And if I'm not careful, I can fly with them. I am to be grounded and not fly. And some of them are extraordinarily selfish, and some of them are extraordinarily dishonest. But if I don't act on them, as this gentleman told us, as Don told us, big deal. It's a thought. But there are times when I act on them. And that's when the 10th step comes into play. The 10th step tells me to watch for 4 things: selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And it says, and when these crop up, I'm to do 4 things. The 10th step is like a 4x4. I look for 4 things, and when I see any combination or any dusting of any one of them, I do 4 things. First is ask God to remove it immediately. Second, discuss it with someone. Third, make amends quickly if I've harmed anyone. And the 4th one, resolutely turn my thoughts to someone I can help. And that plays out in my life. And it's that same thing, that same lesson I keep having to relearn in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it gets deeper and deeper and deeper every time I learn it. And that's that my answer to the problem of alcoholism is not only sobriety. It's not only not taking the first drink. It's really this: prayer and service to others. I didn't know that when I came in. So when I sponsor guys and they call me up, "Mike, you'll never believe what happened. And they did this and she did that. And I can't believe this happened." So, whoa. Where are you? Selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. "Well, I was selfish. I had some dishonesty there, I guess." Okay, a little more now then. So, did you ask God to remove it? "Well, no." "Okay, I'll hold." I'm not going to jump on 12 because that's going to be Timmy's bag. He's going to kill it, by the way. You're in for a treat on 12. But I don't think the men that I sponsor need a lecture from me every single time. I think what they need is the same thing I do, which is connection with God. And if I'm always giving advice and never pointing them to the one who's the answer that can really solve their problem for them, I don't know that I'm doing them justice. I think I might be patting me on the back. I might be. And then I got to go through the damn thing, right? I think my job is to point them to Him, not them to me only, right? It talks about how I must carry the vision of God's will into all my activities. "Thy will, not mine, be done." And I think over the first 9 steps, and as 10 is being practiced in our lives, we get a better vision of that. You know, I had an eye appointment here a couple of years ago, and the optometrist sat me in the chair and he gave me those really cool goggles that he's like, "Tell me which way the E is pointing," right? And then I heard, "How does it look now?" "Oh, a little better." "How about now?" "Better." "How about now?" "Better." And I think that's what happens. I think the application of these first 9 steps and continual practice of 10, we get a clearer vision and a clearer view, and our eyes we can see things with our real eyes. Don talked about realizing. We can see things with our heart that we couldn't see before we started this process. And then we have to act on what we now see. And I say that for a reason, because I was 7 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, trying to do the best I could, and I was active, I was doing things. My life wasn't perfect, but it was way better. And at 7 years, I hit a spot in my recovery. And the people that I was hanging with, who I am still extraordinarily close with and love to death, I felt like they didn't want me to change anymore. I felt like they didn't want me to go further. Now, they never said that, but they would never really encourage me. And as I tried to step out a little bit, I kind of got a little backlash. "Oh, are you going to be holy now?" "Right." "What are you reading? Are you kidding me? Really? Really? Oh, okay. Let us know when you're holy." That was not on my radar. If I've learned anything about alcoholism, and it may be less than some and it may be more than others, I don't know, this is just me talking, but there's a longing in my heart that Carl Jung talked about, that I used alcohol as a replacement for my longing for God. It did things for me that I desperately needed in my heart and in my soul that I couldn't produce myself, and so I took an imposter to do it for me. But the imposter is like Rich Little. At the end of the impression, it's Rich Little. At the end of this imposter, it was drunkenness. And I needed to sort of leave that group in a way, still respecting them, still honoring the traditions, and because they have the right to do whatever they feel they need to do in AA, just like I do, as long as it's within traditional bounds, right? And I needed to sort of separate myself a little bit so I could take that next step, and it was not easy. It was not easy. But I needed to do it. I needed to do it. So if you're out here tonight and you're sort of struggling with that, should I go deeper? What are people going to think? What's my family going to say? How's this people going to react? Just do it. Just do it. If God got you this far, trust me. He didn't get you this far to go, can't wait till they buy this crap. You know what He's going to say? He's going to say, I am right there with you. I am right there with you. He brought us this far. He will bring us further if we'll let Him take us there. Which I think leads to step 11. So sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. Our conscious contact with God. I struggled with what that meant. Right? I mean, I'm looking up words, I'm doing this stuff. Finally, it dawned on me one day. I think it's about intimacy in the moment with God. I think it's that simple. And I got that from a guy I sponsor. Right? So we sponsor a number of people. We have varying levels of open communication with those people, right? Some are very open to us. Some are somewhat, yeah, okay, great, see you at a meeting. Bye. I get this guy and he sends me a text. Hey! Well, I know him well enough. That means I'm dying, right? So I send him a text back. Is he all right? No answer. Then he knows I have a 3 o'clock meeting, so he calls, leaves a voicemail at 3:06 so that I don't answer the phone. So I call him back. He doesn't answer. I go right to voicemail. I invite him to the house. He comes over to the house. He walks in. Hey! High five. He sits down on the couch and we start small talking. 15, 20 minutes into it, he's crying. I don't know, maybe a half hour later, maybe an hour later, I really don't know. We talk about the actions that he needs to take, not a lecture from me. And he got up off that couch and he was resolute in taking those actions and he gave me a hug. And I went, a light came on. I just improved my conscious contact with this pigeon. Started out as a very weak, vague text. And it turned into an embrace in my living room. And if I'm going to improve my conscious contact with God, my intimacy with God must grow along those lines as well. I must open up, find some way to open up. And I didn't get there early. And I don't know that I'm there today. I'm better today. I can't wait what next year brings. Right? Because it'll just be better, I'm sure. But it's really good today. So in the mornings I get up and I pray with my wife. We take some time, we do the 3rd 7-step prayer, we read a little thing together. And then I get quiet time. And I have this thing I watch in the morning. It's a broadcast of some Eucharistic adoration stuff in my house. And I just sit there before the Lord and I just am quiet. I ask Him to direct my thinking so that I don't hurt His kids. So I don't want to hurt His kids anymore. But more than not hurting them, I want to be a part of how He blesses them. And I don't mean that arrogantly. Look, I've just seen when we sponsor people or when we're kind to people and our families, the way their lives are better, the way they glow. You know what I mean? When you really love the people that are around you and how they glow from that, like, I want to be a part of that. I really do. I want to be part of my family knowing that God loves them. Not a part of them on their knees wondering what the heck is wrong. So as I go through the day, I try to stay aware of these things that I've learned through the 9 steps and through the practice of step 10. And they do that in a couple of ways. And these aren't the ways you're supposed to. These are just the ways that I do. These aren't right. These are just Mike's ways. So my computer at work, I have a little picture that I look at every now and then. And every time I see that picture, I ask God to be with me. Because I can get lost. I get lost quick. Work in a very fast-paced business environment. I have a lot of pressure on me to perform. And I have to keep coming back to that moment, that intimacy. At lunch, I'll often go down to the falls. Sioux Falls, we actually have falls in Sioux Falls. It's kind of cool. Genius name makers there. And sometimes I'll just go down to the falls and I'll just sit. Other times I get completely distracted. And I see the picture. Not now. That's still me too. It's still me too. But it's better. It's a lot better. The other thing that I do to try to actualize this in my life, rather than just talk about it, is I read a lot. I try to read things that are ahead of me so that somehow maybe I can be pulled forward by it. You know? I love C.S. Lewis and I love Ignatius of Loyola and I love AA history. Brian gave me a book this weekend about Sam Shoemaker. I wish he'd have read it, but that's another issue. Just kidding. I love listening to AA speakers. I can tell you on this panel, I've listened to a lot of hours of the people that spoke this weekend. And they've helped me, and they've touched me. Many others. Anything by Sandy Beach. Anything. If there was a satellite radio station of Sandy Beach, I would never leave my car, right? It's just true. But there's another side of prayer, I think, that's important for me. And that's that prayer isn't just about being on my knees. You know, I said a lot of very sincere and honest prayers when I was out there drinking. I truly did. And if you're in this room tonight, I'll bet you have too. I've prayed next to, you know, American Standard logos. I've prayed, you know, in the back of police cars, right? The most sincere prayers I had was when I would see the backs of people I love walking away from me. I was like, please, God, please, please, please. And I'm not kidding. Those were not insincere. Like, if I'm really honest, like, I was serious. There was something about sitting, kneeling next to my bed with knots in my gut, just begging God for help, and it seemed like it was bouncing off the ceiling. Like, why did the third step work with Joe, and all those other prayers seemingly not work? I don't have a full answer. I can't speak for him who is. But I think part of it, at least a small part of it, is after the amen, I got up and lived the exact same life I lived before. I think. But when I got off my knees with Joe, he handed me a piece of paper and a pen. He said, start on this process and finish your decision. Because step three is more than a prayer. It's a commitment to work 4 through 12. I think, I don't know, but I think that has something to do with it. The other thing I do is I have this list. And I don't know about you, but I'll get a trial or a tribulation or something will pop up in my life. And I'll pray about it. And it will seemingly sort of get a little God salve on it and heal it up a little bit, you know. And then a month or so will go by and I'll completely forget that I had that issue, right? Or problem or whatever it is. And suddenly it'll be back. And so I found that making a list and writing things down so that I keep praying for them, even though they're put off to the side or arrested or whatever that word might be, so that I keep staying on it so it doesn't come back, because I don't want that crap in my life. So I go through that. I think prayer also is about action, applying it to my life. So if I'm praying and I read something that touches me, or I listen to some of the best speakers on the planet and they touch my heart, I got to act on it. Those principles, those things that I learned in 1 through 9 and continually trying to work 10, I've learned some things, at least for me, and that is that my family needs me to be an active member of it if it's going to thrive. And I don't want us to exist and show up at Thanksgiving and high-five each other. I want my family to thrive. And I don't get all the say in that, and I certainly am not the dictator of that. But I can play a role in it. And my role with my wife is husband, and that's whether she travels with me or not. And as I've come to learn from reading and trying to talk to her and trying to be understanding to her and trying to figure out what this whole thing of marriage is, because the first 5 years of our marriage, I got to tell you, it was horrible. She just didn't understand. And I've come to forgive her for that through the miracle of the steps. Reality is I didn't understand. And I didn't understand that I didn't understand. So now, look, I prep for a lot of meetings. I do a lot of things, and we all have our jobs. We do different things, and I'm prepared for a business meeting. You want a business meeting guy? I'm going to be prepped. An hour and a half before, if it needs that, I'm prepping. And in those days, I would just walk into my house after work. One of the most important meetings of the day. The person that I'm supposed to love in such a way that we help each other get to heaven, I'm prepping for nothing. Somehow that just seemed imbalanced to me. So I pull in my garage and I sit there for 5 or 10 minutes and I ask God to prepare me to go in to meet the woman He gave me. It's pretty awesome. Pretty awesome. When I came in, I thought, wuss, right? What kind of loser does that? You know? And I would hear some men talk about women in the program. And I'd be like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Finally got to be, I don't know. And I found some other guys and I went, yeah, yeah, yeah. He's one of them. I used to pray to not get divorced. And I don't know, over time, Dick's laughing because he understands, or been there and talked to me and helped me. And now I pray that I love my wife in such a way that she knows that God loves her. That she becomes the center of my family and not my demands that I become the center of my family. How do I serve her? What do I do for her? Right? I can have that. I'm also a father. I have 2 stepsons. And they're wonderful. I mean, they're great. Kyle and Cody. Cody's married to Teresa. I have the most beautiful daughter-in-law. You wouldn't even believe it. Cody's married. And they go through things like I went through. And every Friday for the last 10 years, Cody and I have met for breakfast. And we just sit down and talk. We don't do anything. I just get to love my son. And we get to talk about prayer, and we get to talk about marriage, and we get to talk about being a dad, and we get to talk about life and work and how hard it can be, but how wonderful it is. And it's just sitting across from my son and trying to be present. That's another spot for step 11. I'm sitting across from my son having breakfast, and I'm praying to myself constantly, stay here, shut up, stay here, shut up. Just let him be. Talk to him. Just love him. Shut up. Shh. And when I can do that, when I can be there, there's nothing like that. And for a guy who lost his dad at 6, it's just so filling. It's so rewarding, I can't even tell you. You see, I came here to quit drinking, and you gave me a God that gave me my family back. I came here to not drink, and you gave me a God that would give my wife a faithful husband, whether she's with me or not. I didn't know I needed or wanted that. I thought if I could just quit drinking, I would be fine. I tell you what, when I quit drinking, I was a maniac. Because alcoholism has almost nothing to do with drunkenness, just like Joe Friday told me. It's got to do with this broken soul, and if I don't find a gracious God, I'm in trouble. And it's interesting about that gracious God, and I'll close with this. The thing I've found is it's not really me finding Him. It's me awakening to the fact that He already found me. Mari mentioned the hounds of heaven yesterday, and I love that. I love that. God has been chasing me my whole life. I was 6 months sober, and I'm sitting in a meeting, and the nearest guy to me is 14 years. You ever been in one of those ordained meetings, right? And the topic is the difference between an awakening and an experience. Spiritual awakening, spiritual experience. Now, semantics, whatever. But the topic of that conversation, I remember it to this day. And everybody, I passed. I was the first one to the opener. And then I passed because I didn't know what to say. And then it went around. And the last guy summed up the whole meeting with this. He's an extraordinarily good friend of mine today. He said, the difference between a spiritual awakening and a spiritual experience is that when we have a spiritual awakening, we awaken to the fact that we have had spiritual experiences our whole life. That God has been in hot pursuit of us since conception. I don't know what I was running from, but when I stopped running, I found it. My job, like the hounds of heaven, is to stop running and let God catch me. Let Him put His arms around me. Let Him love me. Let Him change me through the actions of these steps in the book. See, when I came in, I thought the steps on the wall were the steps. They're not. They're titles. If you come to my house and we watch a movie, whatever it is, we all know the title of it. But when we stream it on Netflix, it's not the title of the movie for an hour and a half. There's all kinds of stuff going on. There's actors and directors and scenery people and costume designers and all kinds of stuff that aren't even in the movie that made it happen. And when we read that wall and we think those are the steps, like I did, thank God for Joe. Because Joe taught me that those were the titles. But in that big book are the directions. And if I follow the directions, I get the results that the directions promise. That's been true in my life. I really believe that the number one thing that I'm called to do, and the number one thing that this process of these steps do for me, is they open me up to be able to receive from God the love, not only that I need, but as importantly, the love that the people around me need. That I'm not only supposed to have God as some sort of independent helper, that I'm supposed to be conduit. That the love and the forgiveness and the grace and the mercy and the kindness that He has shown me is supposed to work through me to the people that He has put around me first. Whether it's a guy sponsor, whether it's my sponsor, whether it's my friends, certainly my wife and children, and now my grandchildren. There is nothing like a calf hug from a 4-year-old girl. I mean, that's related to you. That's related to you. In today's world, I have to be very specific. I'm having breakfast with my son one day, and he says, How do you name a child? Well, that wasn't on the radar, you know? And I said, well, I don't know, but I know back in biblical days they would pick a name that they felt was a prayer, so that every time they called the child's name, they would be praying for that child. So Teresa has her baby, and they call us up to the room, and they looked at us and said, I want to introduce you to Grace, Elizabeth. How wonderful. And then when they had their boy, they introduced us to Hank. True story. I don't know. So, Hank Michael, so that's good. But I love those kids with all my heart. And I know that I wouldn't be able to do that if people like Brian, people like Tom, people like Dick didn't love me in such a way that I could stick around, go through that book, and find pure love. Love is its essence, God Himself, which changes my heart so that I have enough to go and love His people around me. God bless you all. Have a great weekend. Thank you very, very much.